Okay, well, actually, I thought to give a bit more general talk than that. For strongly correlated electrons, since that's the topic of this workshop. In fact, it's two different subjects that I'm going to treat with the same technique, and I hope that won't confuse you, because the main purpose of this talk is actually to sell this technique. I think this technique is it's a new way of really using numerics to make progress on long-standing models of correlated electrons. And I think, I mean, we can discuss it later with you. I think that some of the problems of trying to solve the problem of complicated atoms in a crystal is amenable to this idea of renormalization. And I'll, okay, so all kinds of magic will come out of this technique, I hope, and acknowledge my two students, Eld Altman, who is going to be at Harvard next year, and Ellisberg, who's finishing his thesis with me now. So these are the two preprints that have a lot of the details, and as again, there's going to be two topics, essentially. One is treating the Hubbard model with an eye to the cuprates, and the other one is to treat the frustrated Heisenberg model on pyroflow lattices. So these are two preprints easy to find. So the outline is the following. First, I'll describe what I mean by renormalization. The word renormalization has been used very heavily by many different approaches, and I want to define precisely what I mean by that and what I mean by an effective Hamiltonian. The contractor renormalization is a way to derive effective Hamiltonians, and its acronym is CORE. I'll explain quite briefly how it's done, not because the principle is quite simple. Then I'll do a brief review of how to apply the CORE to the two-dimensional Hubbard model and arrive an effective boson-fermion model that we believe has a lot of features of the high-temperature superconductors in them, but hasn't been yet completely solved, so it's still work to be done. The quantum frustration part, I'm going to talk about two lattices. The checkerboard is kind of a theorist invention, and the pyroclaw, which is a real lattice that appears in nature. And first I'll describe the problem. The problem in the cuprates, for instance, is that people have postulated the Hubbard model as an important model to understand, has a strong interaction of order U. That model can be reduced by essentially a one-step renormalization to an effective model called the TJ model, eliminating doubly occupied sites, which governs physics at a lower energy scale or temperature scale than Hubbard model. But still, this model is quite entangled. It has a lot of degrees of freedom that interact strongly, and a priori you start with a very highly degenerate system. So it is still a problem that is difficult to solve. What we're really interested in is an effective Hamiltonian at this energy scale that would first give superconductivity and would explain interplay of superconductivity, antiferromagnetism, and everything in between. And that effective model, which is, it should include tightly bound D-wave pairs. This is now summarizing a lot of experimental data. The coherence length is very short. They're in the D-wave symmetry. And the second thing it has to include is antiferromagnetic correlation, something that usually in BCS theory, it's difficult to understand at the same footing as superconductivity. But this effective Hamiltonian is still at much lower energy scale than the Hubbard or the TJ model. And one needs a method of deriving effective Hamiltonians. And that's a very general problem in physics. So the basic question, and I would say one of the major questions in high-TC superconductivity problem is, how can we get all this stuff, tightly bound D-wave pairs, antiferromagnetic correlations, just by starting with the strongly repulsive interacting electrons? In the frustration problem, in the quantum frustration problem, there's a different question people ask, but you'll see it's actually quite similar. At the microscopic scale, there's a Heisenberg interaction. And people know how to use mean field theory to solve for the Heisenberg interaction. You just replace these operators with vectors, minimize the energy of this vector. However, when you want to do that for lattices like this or like this, you find, just by rewriting the Hamiltonian, that there's a huge classical degeneracy that these vectors can point in many different ways. An extensive number of degrees of freedom are left in the ground state manifold. So that didn't really solve the problem. One doesn't believe that there is a finite entropy at zero temperature, so something has to come in, and of course quantum fluctuations are very, very important. So the problem of solving frustrated antiferromagnets is a semi-classical theory, and spin wave theory is poorly controlled, and other things have to be done. So, but looking at it in terms of energy scales, we have a microscopic Hamiltonian with an energy scale J, quite high energies. There's a huge ground state degeneracy here. Let's say as a function of spin configuration, if you want, very roughly, there's a very large degeneracy. There's strong quantum fluctuations. And what we're really interested in is understanding the physics here, not so much here. And there's a long way to go from here to here when there's such large classical degeneracy. So what we really want is to find H effective. We want to find an operator in this subspace whose correlations will give us the ground state symmetry breakings and all the low excitations and the low temperature physics and so on. Now, numerically, people have studied this model, which is a version of the Pyrrhic law in two dimensions. Palman Chokar showed that, very interestingly, there's a huge number of singlets. This is S equals zero. These are singlet states. This is the energy. Large number of singlets, much below the energy scale J. This is on a 20 lattice site, exact degeneralization study in 24 lattice sites. And the question is, what describes those singlets? What? I believe so. I believe so, but other people might know better this water. Okay, I haven't looked at the Kagome at all. The question was still open. What is going on here? What is going on? What's the effect of Hamiltonian? I believe. Yes. Right. Okay. Okay. No, I'm not. I'm not saying that this is particularly. Larger than I think Leo did much larger sizes. The main problem is, okay, you have all these singlets. You ask yourself, what is the effect of Hamiltonian that describes all these singlets? And as you say, they appear also in other frustrated systems. Yeah, I think they, okay. We can talk later about how general this result is, but the main idea that I was showing before is that the Heisenberg model at its microscopic level is far removed from understanding all these singlets. You have to do some step to go from the microscopics to the low energy physics. Okay, so this is just a review that will look quite simple to for most of you, but I want to point out different approaches. To start from something microscopic and end up with low energy, one way is the k-space renormalization. For fermions and also for bosons, you can follow the way the Shankar's in a very pedagogical way explained. You eliminate, let's say, single particle, this is an important word here, single particle states at large momentum to obtain a smaller Brillouin zone, if you want, with a different Hamiltonian, or a different action. The way you did it is in the path integral. You have a path integral where you integrate over all degrees of freedom. You have some interacting Hamiltonian here, some kinetic term, and you integrate out all Fourier components larger than some k prime. And you end up, instead of the same action that you had before, with a new action. This action has several features. One of them is that it is a functional of fields at different times, and it's quite complicated in general. But you can expand it in certain cases. And let's say the quadratic part you will call the new free Hamiltonian quotations. It'll have an object called self-energy instead of an energy. And the property of a self-energy is that it depends on the frequency. So if you look in real time, this is like time-retarded interactions. So if you just look at everything except the I omega, you can say, well, this looks like a functional integral of a new Hamiltonian, which are all these terms. But don't forget, it's not really a Hamiltonian. It has omega in it. This is very important. So functional integrals of normalization and quantum problems in general always suffer from the problem that when you integrate out degrees of freedom, you don't end up with a Hamiltonian. You end up with a new action, but it is not really a Hamiltonian. And that's important for further what I'm going to talk about. So the normalization group in general in this particular approach says, fine, you have an action, you change K, you get a new action. That new action, if it looks similar to the old action, will have a new sigma and a new F, and you just follow the F and sigma in some kind of a flow. And from the microscopic model here, as you take K lower and lower, you'll end up with a new microscopic model, perhaps something that you can solve more easily. Perhaps some of the interactions vanish in this flow and are irrelevant, and life becomes simpler, and you obtain a description for the low energy physics. That is the traditional K-space RG, but it relies on a provision that you want the action to more or less stay in the same form so you can follow things like sigma and F and still talk sensibly about the new actions. And that's a restriction that doesn't necessarily have to be there, but it makes it convenient for K-space normalization. There's another way of doing a normalization, and that's by canonical transformation. I already... What? With a can. Yeah. Okay. So let's take the Hubbard model at half filling. We have two states of singly occupied, and that happens to be on the same side, quite a large gap of ODU for doubly occupied states, and if you tune the chemical potential also for empty states, and you say, okay, this is a complicated Hamiltonian, can it be simplified? Well, a Schrieffer-Wolf transformation eliminates the high doubly occupied and empty states in favor of interactions between different sites of order T squared over U, and this is called the Heisenberg model. And this model is an effective Hamiltonian for the low energy physics of the Hubbard model at half filling, which we know is a very useful thing to have. And it has some corrections of order T over U and the energy divided by U. And this is really the way to go if you want to understand low energy physics of multi-insulators. If you try directly on this Hamiltonian to do approximation schemes, many times you'll get wrong results. You get different mean field theories that would give you conflicting directions. And any state, variational state that you tune for this Hamiltonian will most likely work very hard to minimize the energy, essentially to eliminate double occupied sites, but will give you perhaps terrible long-range correlations. On the other hand, this model is much more amenable to theoretical techniques. It has a reduced Hilbert space, so it's better for numerics. It has bosonic kind of degrees of freedom instead of fermionic, so it's going to have minus sign problems and such. Therefore, better mean field approximations work on it, like large S, semi-classical, large N, with different representations. And that model has been studied, and quite a lot is known about it because of this renormalization. However, there are two problems here. One, it relies on a small parameter T over U. So it's essentially a perturbation, an RG, one-step RG, that relies on a small parameter. And again, H of E is not really an effective Hamiltonian because it has energy dependence. When you do this canonical transformation, you cannot get rid of the fact that this Hamiltonian has in it some energy dependence that we ignore, but in certain cases can be important. So again, this is something that we want to overcome. Now, okay, so we said, never mind renormalization group, let's just do numerics. Take the damn model, put it on a lattice, diagonalize it. That's only justified in certain cases. Sometimes the energy dependence is a big problem. Not always, but sometimes it is. When they have holes in the self-energy at low energies. Right. Okay. Well, depends on the problem. I'm talking generally now. Okay, what I want to say is the following. The reason that Marvin Weinstein worked on this method and devised this partly was problems of energy dependence in the effective momenton. He wanted to have an exact transformation and didn't want approximations at the level of when you define the transformation. You can later make approximations, try to control them. But one of his problems was, and I think it's correct, to try to define the transformation from Hamiltonian to Hamiltonian. Why? Because if you have a matrix that depends on energy, the number of eigenstates is not the size of the Hilbert space. Right? So, okay. So he wanted to have control over that, and I think, okay, that maybe in certain cases you don't care about it, in others you do. Okay, if you just do numerics, what do you run into? You want to solve a problem of size L by L. The system has some correlation, like let's say it's a magnet wanting to order at some parameter, temperature or some other quantum parameter, and it has a finite correlation length. In order to get the correlations of the ground state, if you're interested in correlations, that's the crucial word, you have to do what's called finite size scaling. You have to go to larger and larger systems, and you'll get some parameter S, some observable, and it will change. And above that length scale, it will start to go into something that you can extrapolate to infinite size system to obtain what you want is the thermodynamic value of this observable. However, notice the condition is always make the system larger than the correlation. Now, you know the computation time in many body problems, not in single particle problems, in many body problems, is exponential in the size of the system. And if size large, especially if you're in a phase that orders or something interesting is happening there, it's very futile to try to get the thermodynamics correlations from any exact organizations or methods of looking at wave functions and correlations. It's difficult. I was going to say futile. You have to be very clever about it. Eventually, you run into the wall. You see, and then I'm sure that Didier will testify the wall is pretty high and strong. Okay. Question is, what can we do? So what are numerics good for? Well, I want to propose a different idea. What we really want is obtaining low energy degrees of freedom in effective Hamiltonian. Sometimes degrees of freedom emerge. You don't know what they are until you start solving the problem. So this is a, sorry I'm taking it from some kind of a more public colloquium, but I'm sure that you'll recognize some of your own problems in this scheme. You start with, just a second, you start with a QCD, okay? You start with QCD. You have gauge fields, quarks, leptons, and so on. Now, you have to work very hard, but out of QCD emerge nucleons, bound quarks, and more free electrons. And out of the nucleons and leptons at much lower energy scales, six order of magnitudes lower, you start obtaining atomic physics, where you use completely different equations. You use the Schrödinger equation with degrees of freedom that are essentially collective degrees of freedom of the original. And then when you want to go to chemistry, you have to do very fine tuning of the different interactions atoms have, van der Waals interactions and bonding and so on, which involve very small energy scales. But you're using existing structures all the time. If you try to do directly mean field theory on QCD to get the structure here, it reminds me of the following. When I was a student in Hebrew University, I studied physical chemistry under Professor Levine, and he gave us the question of how do you know if the molecule looks like this, or the OH is here, and the ligands, you know, whatever you connect here is on the other side. So there was some guy sitting in front, one of you, looked clever, he said, well, I'll just solve the Schrodinger equation. And he said, okay, that's exactly like trying to get the captain's weight by weighing the ship with the captain, subtracting the two, and finding his weight from there. And this is exactly the problem of trying to solve interacting electron model, or perhaps, you know, a complicated theory of electronic structure of atoms and molecules in lattices, when you just apply your approximations on the microscopic Hamiltonian. It's exactly the same problem. Now, this is the opposite case when the captain weighs a lot, so that might work for that problem. But anyways, the basic idea is that when you do numerical renormalization, you derive an effective Hamiltonian. All you need for deriving an effective Hamiltonian is not a very large system. All you need is the size of a system to be larger than some lengths, which I call coherence length. It's not a correlation length. It's a size of emerging structures, like atoms, if you want. In my problem, I'm interested in triplets. I'm interested in whole pairs. Somebody else is interested in DNA. Whatever local structures you're looking at, they are much smaller than the eventual correlation length of, let's say, spin-spin correlation function. So you see, all I need is relatively small numerics, but I won't get ground state correlations. I'll get interactions. So the coherence is the size of these atoms. I don't know a priori what they are, but I can get them. I have to find a way to identify these atoms and calculate the effective couplings. And this is precisely what the contractor normalization can do. And without bias, without saying a priori, I know that these are the low structures. It will come out, and that's what the way we understood this paper. Now this paper, which I recommend people should look at it, it's a paper written for lattice gauge theorists. It is very long, very difficult to extract the stuff I'm talking to you about now, because, I don't know, because historically the way they got to the method was in a roundabout way, and I will explain it in different words, and if you want our way of explaining it, you should read our paper, but the idea was all there. You take a lattice, and you divide it into blocks. That's the usual real space RG that was divided for classical problems. Okay, so now I'm explaining quite briefly the method, and you see it's quite straightforward. For every block, which happens here to be a plaquette, but could be any structure I want, I have a complete freedom of picking any covering of the lattice I want. I will diagonalize the Hamiltonian on the block and get n states. And I will truncate the spectrum at some m, where m is, again, a number I can choose at will. Now, the states that I keep, which of course will be the ground state, the first excited state, and so on, up to m, will define my atoms. They will define my degrees of freedom that later will be used as my new collective degrees of freedom. In the Hubbard model, these would be triplets, whole pairs, single wholes, and so on. Okay, now the method itself generally works as follows. I pick a particular cluster of n blocks, let's say this L-shaped system. It's part of the large lattice, and I just look at the Hamiltonian on this cluster with all the bonds the same strength. I'm not weakening any bonds here. And I just solve, and I first of all write the reduced Hilbert space as the product of these maintained states of each block. These are the three states I maintained, let's say, on each plaquette. Yes, they have to connect. They have to connect. So I choose a connected subcluster, anything. I write the product Hilbert space on that connected subcluster in terms of the eigenstates I keep on these clusters. This is not the full Hilbert space, of course. It has dimension m to the n instead of... Yes, each site is in the covering. Yeah. What? So all sites are covered. You don't share what? Right. You shouldn't overcount the site. Yeah, right. So my full Hilbert space, of course, will be taking the full spectrum of each pore and just making a product space. That will cover the full Hilbert space. But I'm truncating. I'm not keeping all the states, which, you know, if it's a Heisenberg model, there'd be 16 states here. I may keep only four. Now I go from block to cluster, right? So question is, what do I do? I diagonalize the original microscopic Hamiltonian on the full connected cluster that I chose. So let's say Heisenberg model, Hilbert model, I just diagonalize it on this funny shaped object. So I'll get, what do I get? I get a list of states, and I'll get a list of energies, epsilon n, n. Now, since I'm only interested in a reduced Hilbert space, I can just pick, essentially, the reduced Hilbert space as a basis to describe my eigenstates n, my full eigenstates, project the full eigenstates down to the subspace that I call reduced Hilbert space of the cluster, and I end up with actually states which are not normalized and not orthogonal, right? Because if I take a vector and I look at only this component of this, then it's first of all not unit vector, and second, it's not orthogonal to the projection of another vector. So I have to orthogonalize them. After I project to the reduced Hilbert space, I, from the ground state up, orthonormalize the set. So this is the usual Gram-Schmidt procedure. You take a state n, and you project out its components relative to the previous state, psi m, and then you take the whole thing, and you make it a unit norm. And this will give you a list of, if you want, butchered, I call them, wave functions in the reduced Hilbert space. However, the important thing is, these energies are the exact energies of the full Hamiltonian on this cluster. So what do I get from it? I get an effective renormalized Hamiltonian, let's call it. It has, of course, by construction, the right spectrum. It has butchered wave functions, orthogonal, and their number is the number of their projected Hilbert space. And this is a renormalized Hamiltonian. This is step one. Say, so far I didn't gain anything. I just diagonalized the Hamiltonian on some cluster. I had to work a lot, the cluster is big, and I had to get states and eigenstates. You don't see the use of this so far. Okay, in general, this choice, unless, you know, you really made, you know, unless really the eigenstates are orthogonal to all the states in this produced Hilbert space, which has to be a... Okay. Okay, for the problems we did, we didn't find that problem in general, and you have to kind of look for one state that happens to be, you know, very poorly projected or very small overlap with this reduced Hilbert space, which has low energy. If you have a lot of those, it means that you have probably chosen the bad clusters and truncated badly. You see, there's the two parameters that you have a choice of, but in general, it shouldn't happen. There's no reason by symmetry that the eigenstates would not have a nice, some overlap with these projected states. You know, this already becomes the tricks of the trade, how to pick the such that you have a large overlap and so on. But let me just talk about generalities, and I'll say, you see, I want to summarize all the approximations in one move that I'll make. And so far, I've not made any approximations or any assumptions. If there will be a control, so if my method is bad, I will see it. I will, it will. Right. I have, well, by construction, right? I have the exact energy of the cluster, not of the full lattice. But I'm not interested in the full lattice. No. I diagonalize the full Hamiltonian on that cluster, and I obtain the exact energy of the full Hamiltonian on that cluster. So, by construction. These guys. Yes. Yeah, let's say I keep the singlet, triplet, and I throw away spin 2, spin 5, spin 6, or there I truncate, if you want, I truncate the Hilbert space of the plaquette. Now I go and forget about that Hilbert space for a second. I diagonalize the Hamiltonian on this funny cluster. A full Hamiltonian and the full cluster. I obtain epsilon n. Then I project the exact eigenstates onto this Hilbert space, notwithstanding Gabi's comment about absence of overlap. I will find new wave functions in the reduced Hilbert space, and I will just call this, that's fine, I can call anything I want, right? I call this renormalized Hamiltonian of this subcluster. It has the exact spectrum by construction. Subset, yeah, right. Only the low, yeah, right. Below the number is the dimension m to the n, right? Okay. So I haven't done really anything so far, so don't get excited. It has nothing to do with that metric synonymization. No, I don't want to discuss DMRG here because, first of all, I don't know much about it. And second, I believe it's a very different philosophy of doing, you know, finite size scaling. Well, I'm not looking at correlations. Remember, what I will try to develop, and this is very different from DMRG, I'm not trying to find the ground state wave function or the ground state energies or anything. I'm trying to define the effective interactions in a model which I haven't solved. But I want to define those effective interactions as precisely as possible. Okay? So let me go to the next step. The next step is to define effective interactions. These effective interactions is kind of a circular way of defining them. You take this renormalized Hamiltonian, it's on some cluster, and you subtract from it all the small h's which are defined on any connected subcluster of this cluster. See, connected subcluster. Now, of course, I can start, this is like an iterative procedure. First, I'll start with small h of 1, and that is exactly equal to big H. But when I take 2, so let's say this is 2 connected plaquettes, all I have to subtract is the 2 single plaquette Hamiltonians, because they're the only connected subclusters of 2. When I go to 3, I'll have to subtract the 2 2s and the 3 3s. Yeah, it's quite common in cluster expansions. And so far, it's a definition. It's a definition you can work with. You can define these H's and slowly build up the H's of longer and longer range. Now, what I claim is that these H's now, after subtracting, you know, after taking the subclusters and subtracting the smaller subcluster H's, are interactions, okay? They are what you call effective interactions. No. These are many body Hamiltonians in any Hilbert space. Yeah. Many body. Right. So, and the point is that I want just to define these H's because these H's happen to obey a wonderful cluster expansion, which looks as follows. Now I go to the infinite lattice. I go to the infinite lattice, or maybe a lattice finite, but as big as I want. And I can write the effective Hamiltonian on the infinite lattice as a sum of terms. The terms are the following. The small h's of single plaquettes, the small h's of 2 connected plaquettes, 3 connected plaquettes, 4, up to essentially the size of the lattice. I can prove this in like one line. It's trivial. It's really trivial because it's like a telescopic sum. Everything adds up to give you the full Hamiltonian is equal to the full Hamiltonian. The way of writing is essentially the magic of God. By the right way of writing it, I essentially isolated interactions according to range, and I have a way of constructing the effective Hamiltonian by slowly diagonalizing larger and larger clusters. You see, each small h demands that you know how to exactly diagonalize a larger cluster. Now, the large cluster might be 4 by 4, but the question then becomes, if I truncate this, throw away the terms that are longer range, what error do I make? Okay, if you look, okay, I haven't given you examples of what the term looks like. You're right. Okay, I'll explain. Both. In this term, H, I extract operator content. What it means that I will write this H as one body, two body, three body, you know, let's say spin, okay? One spin, two spin, three spin, up to four spin, you know, if it's four, if range four, let's say. And the terms look more and more complicated. However, I can, let's say, group from all these terms the one spin, I can group off from all these terms the two spin and so on, and I'll get essentially a Hamiltonian which has longer and longer range. Question, yeah. Yeah, the IJs here are just the description of the subclusters of the full lattice. You see, every full lattice is made of... No. Nearest neighbor. I know, but here you start getting... Yes, your answer is right. IJ is nearest neighbor. This is next nearest neighbor. However, here you will have a connection between spin at site I and spin at site K. The range is the you know is defined by the number of sites, and the question is, you know, can you stop this expansion? Yeah, I'm talking about lattice models with nearest neighbor interactions. Yeah. That was the look when I defined it, my original lattice. I defined a square lattice. That means, well, it doesn't have any meaning when you have long-range interaction on square lattice, and you have to draw these bonds, right? So my lattice, my original lattice defined the microscopic bond, okay? Okay, you know what I mean. Okay, so I want to truncate this at finite range. Yes. I won't get anywhere. Oh, I have beautiful examples of tight binding models. Let me show you later. Okay. So, I claim the following, and this is very important. I claim the following. This might converge or might not converge. This depends on the problem. This depends on the choice of clusters. This depends also on the truncation, or the truncation of states in the plaquette. But there might be a short emerging length scale coming, and in problems we know how to solve, like the negative U-Hubbard model, and certain other cases, you can actually calculate this. And this really controls the fall-off of these interactions. So what controls the fall-off is not the correlation length of the problem, because we're not calculating correlations, but it's some kind of a coherence length, which tells you that the degrees of freedom that you chose at the plaquette level are really constitute the correct low-lying degrees of freedom of the lattice. Let's say if you found here bosons, then the system is really a system of hardcore bosons. You found here triplets, then you have a system that looks like, you know, Heisenberg system at low energies, and we'll give different examples of singlets and so on. So, but there's always a length scale that will help you control this expansion. No, there's not always. You hope there's a length scale that helps you control that thing. Okay. So there were problems that there's no such length scale, and it was still solved by Kaur very beautifully. So you see that the application is perhaps wider than what I was saying. And the best example is the spin and half Heisenberg chain, whose correlations are power law. They fall off like 1 over R. And you think this is the worst thing for a real space for normalization. So what Monistar and Weinstein did is they just looked at ground state energy, look at the on, so truncated essentially at every site, every two sites, all the states except the singlet. You think, what information do you have there? Well, you have the ground state energy. And they got a different interaction range up to range 6. So that means they had to diagonalize 12 sites. They got the number for the ground state to be 0.442. The exact result is 4.3. However, they said, just a minute, I have all this information about the interaction range. Let me padate. In other words, I have 6 points as a function of distance. So let me just extrapolate it with a ratio, with a functional, a rational function, up to infinite range. When you do that, you get the ground state energy to be 4431412. Extremely high accuracy for extremely low computational power. While I think that other methods, except for those of Beta Ansatz, are much more time consuming, the reason it's so efficient is we're not chasing after ground state correlations. We're keeping interactions. It's a much more economical way of handling what the Hamiltonian is doing. He didn't do correlations there. I think he didn't do it. This was just a proof of, he had to compete with these other methods, DMRG and so on, that do ground state energy very well and so on. I don't think this is particularly useful for what I'm interested in, but it's a sign that, you might have some, in some cases, not a short coherence length, but an analytic function of the interaction range that you can extrapolate, and then you'll get good results. But even if you just truncated the interactions at range 6, you'll do very well on the energy, because you're not saying anything about the long-range correlations. You're just truncating an effective Hamiltonian. In that case, yes. In that case. But in other cases, the problem sometimes becomes simpler. So, actually, I think in this case, in the Hubbard model, life is actually simpler when you truncate. And let's look at the Hubbard plaquette. The Hubbard plaquette actually is a very interesting system, has lots of states, 80 states, but I'm only interested in the very low ones. The ground state at half filling is a singlet. The first excited state at half filling is a triplet with momentum pi pi on this kind of a tiny brilliant zone. And then, interestingly enough, when you dope it with two holes, you get a singlet, momentum zero, with D wave symmetry under 90 degree rotations. The ground state is called an RVB vacuum. If you look at its kind of projection onto singly occupied sites, this is the Hubbard model, but it's really very simple to prove. The triplets, I would call a boson of, the triplets are three triplets, so it's like a boson excitation on this vacuum. This degree of freedom, I'll call another boson, which is the D-wave whole pair. So I'm just defining my states using second quantized operators, no harm in there. And these states actually are interesting. There are two degenerate fermion states, momentum phi 0, 0, phi. Admixture of those actually would give you chiral states. But these states are a tiny bit higher than both the whole pair and the vacuum, which is a sign of pair binding. It's a sign that this model actually wants to take holes and put them together on the same plaquette, even though the original interaction is positive. That pair binding on a plaquette is very important, actually, both to give us the D-wave symmetry of the order parameter and to actually create the bosonic type of degrees of freedom at low energies. Now, this there's another interesting thing that, by the way, look, there's quite a large energy between the whole pair and the whole pair in the triplet state. This is a repulsive interaction between magnetism and superconductivity on the one plaquette level. It means that the two kinds of bosons, if you want, the triplet and the whole pair, have a strong repulsive interaction. But we... It's a very tiny in the scale of J. It's about 0.01 J, or a point... No, it's about a tenth of J. Well, the only parameter in this model, if you want, is P over U, so, yeah. So we have both antiferromagnetic and superconducting degrees of freedom on the plaquette. question is, what does the plaquette have to do with the lattice? And here we use core. The core will actually allow us to describe the motion and the interactions of these objects at low energies. And there are magnons, there are three magnons, there's a Hall pair, there's these fermions, and there's these vacuum. And the calculation of all the parameters was done by my student Erd Haltman. And this is the paper that derives those interactions by diagonalizing plaquettes 2 and 3 cluster. And now, Sylvain Caponi is working on 4x4 and getting also the fermions. We just did the bosonic part of the spectrum. But I want to show you very briefly, because I don't want to give a talk on high TC. I just want to go show a very important point about pair binding. I'll show it, but it's a completely different talk to describe all the, but okay. There's one point that's important. People say, oh, what's new about core? You just take, weaken the bonds between the plaquettes, do perturbation theory in the size of the bond relative to some energy scale of the plaquette, and that will connect the plaquettes. That is a good idea in many cases, a terrible idea for the Hubbard model. Why? Because what is important for whole pair is, in that case, the ratio of the hopping, T squared, divided by the pair binding energy, which breaks the pair into 2 fermions, right? That's the virtual energy by taking one at a time. However, this energy is very, very small, as I said. And when you do perturbation theory, you see T prime over T gives you a ground state energy of the 2 holes that goes like this. However, the exact ground state energy of taking the full cluster is very, very different. You would get very wrong answers if you plug T prime equal to 1. And I think this is the problem that held back the community a long time. If people knew about pair binding on the plaquette, they said, fine, on the plaquette you have pair binding, in the lattice the pairs disintegrate. Nothing to do with superconductivity. However, they based their estimates on this kind of a assumption. They didn't do a non-perturbative analysis of connecting between the plaquettes. And that's what we check here. We take, let's say, 3 plaquettes, but we solve for the effective Hamiltonian derived at range 2. So we have an approximate Hamiltonian for 3 sites, if you want, using H12, H23, and you get the spectrum. That's the effective spectrum. This is the exact spectrum of 3. And the error in the truncation is marked by the differences in the spectrum. In other words, the matrix elements of the operators of the range 3 interaction, you can see by the mismatch of the exact to the effective. And you see the mismatch is very small, especially for the important states, the ground state and the first triplet for the Heisenberg. So it's an excellent approximation for the Heisenberg model to truncate at range 2. And even for the 2-hole problem, the singlet hole pair is very good. And even the singlet, the hole pair with the triplet is quite good. Then there's some level crossings and so on. So this is essentially a measure of the truncation error. No, this is a scheme to deal with a 2-dimensional lattice. No, I'm looking at convergence of interactions. Then I take those interactions and I'll put them with the route counting on any lattice I want. 3-dimensional, 2-dimensional. Yeah, yeah. This is, well, we have now calculations for other geometries and so on, but for longer range, but the purpose here is to show, is truncating the interaction at range 2 a good idea? So we do the 1 step higher. We can't do much bigger than that. And we see that range 2 already covers the physics of 3 plaquettes very well. Now, the idea is that if the range of interactions is short and the interactions decay numerically, the coupling constants are very, very small. They are like 2 orders of magnitude smaller for range 4 than for range 2. On the 2-dimensional lattice, all you have to do is put the range 2 on all the possible directions that you have on a 2-dimensional lattice, and you get an effective Hamiltonian. Yeah, no, we, okay, actually, Didier and Sylvain, they did, you know, clusters like L-shaped and bigger and four. And this is just the boson sector. We threw out the fermions. So in other words, we truncated the fermions in this problem. And if you want to, So one important thing that, this is comparing to experiments, I apologize for this talk, but there is a very short coherence length in the high TC materials. And this is consistent with the fact that the whole pair is very tightly bound. And the question that people raised in the beginning, why do the whole pairs maintain their integrity as they were seeing by very large lattices of DMRG, they looked at the whole-hole correlation and they found they're essentially a lattice constant, even though this is a large lattice. So this short coherence length is both seen in the convergence of core and in larger DMRG studies and experimentally. It's really the property of the Hubbard model to have short, tightly bound D-wave pair. This is the effective four-boson model, which we derived all the parameters, plus a lot of interactions. There's a table in the paper. These interactions reflect excited state interactions of triplets with triplets, triplets with whole pairs. The two important parts of the model are essentially whole pairs, which is essentially hardcore bosons on a two-dimensional lattice, and magnons that, in absence of whole pairs, would like to condense and give you an AL state. Because when a magnon condenses and mixes with a triplet, a triplet mixes with a singlet, you get an AL state. So there's two Bose condensations competing with each other, the antiferromagnetic and the whole pairs. Yes? Good question. The JT as a function of U and JTT prime, they're very close together. So essentially, you can say it's one coupling constant. The JB is of the same order of magnitude. This is a surprise because it says that the whole pairs zip around quite fast. They zip around with the same energy scale of J. Something that was not necessarily expected. The single hole problem is highly frustrated because of the antiferromagnetic environment. But the two holes zip around with a large J. Now, the value of J being close to JT was postulated essentially on a phenomenological level by Schulchang and co-authors, including myself, in a theory called projective SO5. This theory had a tortuous root. Eventually, it ended up with this Hamiltonian. And there was a statement that there is some symmetry in the problem that requires JB to be equal to JT. Here, we just get that in some range of U, indeed, the two numbers are close to each other. So, in fact, a lot of the mean field theory and the numerics done later by this group applies to this model, and they get a lot of the features of the phase diagram and the first order transition between superconductivity and antiferromagnetism, the Umura plot, the fact that because it's hardcore boson counted from half filling, that's very important. A lot of the theories describe the bosons as electrons, but here they're counted from half filling. So the superfluid density going linearly with the doping concentration, and PC depending on that, is now kind of all tied together, understood in terms of these whole pair bosons, which have D-wave symmetry. Very different from BCS theory. BCS theory, in contrast to what we did here, is a K-space renormalization. Here, the structures that we're looking for are so small, the K-space renormalization is not a good idea, because the structures here mix K at very large distances. K near pi 0 is mixed with pi pi with 0, 0, because we're looking at, essentially, lattice scale pairs. So these relations, like the superfluid stiffness being essentially like the Fermi energy, and TC being much smaller number depending on phonon frequency, and the number of electrons being very large, and all these numbers very much unrelated, as you can see here in the BCS theory, are very different in the high TC materials. So, actually, I want... Yeah. Yes, I covered them. Yeah, there's hardcore interactions, first of all, and then there's these interactions I had. The fermions?
Sorry, the magnons.
Yeah, all these are hardcore, remember, because the plaquettes have only... Okay, so, again, I want to go to Pyroclase. I know that I'm really running out of time, but the Pyroclase is also a system that is very amenable to this idea of clustering. Because if we cluster, let's say, in this case, tetrahedra, and write an effective Hamiltonian by truncating the single tetrahedral spectrum with twofold degenerate. So if I truncate the space here, I get a pseudo-spin representing my low energy degrees of freedom. And those pseudo-spins have directions in space that essentially tell you where the singlets are on the tetrahedra. And when you write the interactions, we went to quite large ranges, as you see, and found that the interactions converge. You get an Hamiltonian that is essentially like an Ising-like Hamiltonian, except instead of SZSZ, it's S dot some vector that depends on the direction on the lattice. So it's a model that you can do mean field theory on. Its energy scale is quite small. There are two minima for the ground state energy as a function of directions of the pseudospin, and therefore it's really like an Ising model. The directions of the pseudospins reflect the directions of the singlet correlations, and there's two columnar states. And those columnar states have overlap with the two distinct ground states, which are the plaquettized states on this lattice and on this sublattice. Let me do it again. You see, there's two orthogonal states that are captured. Okay, I went a bit faster, I'm sorry. Okay, let's go back to the variables. The two singlets on the tetrahedra are, you can write them essentially in terms of dimer singlets. Four, but they're all connected to each other. So it's highly degenerate classically, and it has, unlike the Heisenberg model, it has two degenerate states. And you have to pick between the two. There's interactions between that pseudo spin, and it orders. And what we show is that we can understand the ground state and the excitations based on the pseudo spin language. Yeah, the gap was. I think it's about a J. The gap is about a J, and the small gap for the singlet is half that. And you see the excitations of the systems are domain walls between these different ground states. So these are the singlets that we saw before numerically. And the number of singlets scales essentially. The low-lying singlet is a single spin flip, so the number here scales with n, the size of the system. And those things have not been checked yet, but No. Right. Effective theory is, yeah, it's... Right. So this is the mean field on that Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian has essentially Ising-like interactions, if you want. Let's say these are, you know, some vectors that actually rotate in X and Y direction are not the same direction. So it's like Z in one direction and something else in another direction. So not exactly Ising. You can write it in terms of Z, but then you'll have S plus and S minus term, like quantum fluctuation terms as well. Well, it's actually contracted, right? But it's a spin half. Not Ising, it's Heisenberg, actually. So spin a half. It's quantum. Well, very anisotropic, yeah. What Did they connect it perturbatively, right?
Sure. They were connected.
So we have to do it again with four. But yes, it might give you the same result. Okay, I haven't. The idea of getting an effective Hamiltonian by looking at a cluster and connecting it is old. Here, there's just a method of doing it non-perturbatively. So you're not. I'm not assuming that these bonds are weak. That's all. Okay. Let me. No. Okay. Not. Okay, that method for the Pyrov law, which is a much more complicated method, much more complicated problem, was not successful as far as I know. So we have a way of doing the Pyrov law too. So I think that you're right. You could do perturbation theory in the coupling between two and get this HIJ perturbatively. Right, and that probably gives the right result for the checkerboard. But yes. Yeah, it's, yeah, right. Each direction on the lattice. Yes. So, okay. These are the directions that you want in XZ plane. They're in the real plane, X and Z, not Y. Right. That's a very degenerate model, actually. A mean field theory is like XY. Okay, we didn't do, you know, great simulations on this model, which I think should be done. All we did was mean field theory, and that already gives you a selection of two ground states that look reasonable, agree with, you know, the other method, and there's no reason to search for a much better solution. However, in the Pyrov law, that's not the case. So let me show you the case of the Pyrov law. So the Pyrov law, which is a good exercise on. So the Pyrov law is a very fast rate. It is what Shivaji says is the world's most fast rate. Okay, the tetrahedra, okay? The tetrahedra is twofold degenerate. There's no mean field order down to zero temperature. There's enormous amount of classical frustration. And when you do the quantum case, and you truncate the low-lying states of each tetrahedra, which I said is twofold, then what you do is you pick every second tetrahedra that covers the lattice, and you write a pseudo-spin for each one of them, and this is the effective Hamiltonian. Now, you actually, when you do two, by perturbation theory you get zero, and also by Kohl you get zero for any two-spin interaction evaluated by diagonalizing two clusters. But if you do three, and four, you start getting coupling between those spins. So if you want, your two cluster interaction comes from three cluster diagonalization. And that's why it's difficult to get just by perturbing in weak bonds. So anyways, we get these three, we get also the four, which are smaller and not important. You're right, it's a mistake. Okay. Yes, sum of all triplets, because it came from the range three interaction, but you see, if you take the half here, then you have a two-body interaction of range from I and J that depends on the vector IJK. So it's also four, we did four. I think we did all threes that mattered, because three in a row by symmetry has no interactions. Okay, so we did all range three we could, and range four. Okay, I don't have the table of the vectors, but there's a complicated table depending on I, J, and K on the lattice and the direction. It's actually in our paper and also in previous perturbative treatments that were done by Brooks Harris and John Belinsky. And what? Yes, you get them. You get them from just writing the operators, fixing to the renormalized Hamiltonian. Those come up. Now notice that when you do mean field theory on this, at least naive simple mean field theory, not solving the quantum problem, but, you know, trying to pick directions of these S's, you get three sublattice order nicely. The fourth one has no interaction, completely degenerate. So you say, well, we haven't really solved the problem then, because we're left with the ground state degeneracy even at the mean field level. If mean field can't help us, we have to diagonalize the quantum problem. Except now we're going to look at quantum problems of much larger spins. No way we can do it numerically. The only way to proceed is to take this model, not the original Heisenberg, and diagonalize it on larger clusters using a second step of core. The second core step is a supertetrahedra. Supertetrahedra is four-coupled into another tetrahedral shape. When you diagonalize the effective momentum, actually also the original Heisenberg, on this cluster, you find, unsurprisingly, another two-fold degenerate state. Now, these two degenerate singlets are quite extended. They are essentially correlations on 12 sites that have singlet. You know, they are different representations of the tetrahedral group. Instead of the same representation, but different members of a representation of the tetrahedral group, absolutely degenerate on this cluster. But since we have an effective Hamiltonian, and that's the advantage of the effective Hamiltonian, we can now couple the supertetrahedra. But the supertetrahedra, unlike the original tetrahedra that live on an FCC lattice, this lives on a cubic lattice. So we're closer to finding a model we can solve. And Ehresberg did quantum Monte Carlo on this model, and in field theory, and he showed that the lowest energy was in this kind of an anti-ferromagnetic pseudospin correlation on planes, breaks lattice symmetry, but as you see, quite weakly, because these are large supertetrahedra. And that's the result. So as symmetry breaking, transitional symmetry breaking, that, and the coherence length is the size of a supertetrahedra. That's what we believe. Now, of course, we can't prove it unless we go to much larger clusters to show that the interactions are well converged, and there's no, but I think you, there's no method you can do so many spins. Oh, this is a good question. So the original model had J equal 1. The intermediate one core step at J 0.1 and still had classical degeneracy or mean field degeneracy. And the energy scale that lifts all degeneracies is 10 to the minus 2. So you see what frustration does to energy scales. But this is already the theory of the low-lying excitations, spin a half. We believe some of those features will survive for larger spin. But of course, when you take larger spin, the spin gap comes down, and the system wants to order in some way. This is, of course, a singlet ground state, no long range, exponentially short, essentially one supertetrahedra range correlation. Yeah. Yes. Four also. Yeah. Four is the maximum we could do. Four tetrahedra. Well, 16 sites. Yeah. Okay, we saw that the four is much smaller than the three. So the five, the six, we believe is going to be smaller. But again, this is what you do in approximation. You stop when you're ahead. Right? What? No. This is an energy scale whose corrections are an order of magnitude smaller. So our effective Hamiltonian, the overall constant is at 10 to minus 2, but these terms are the big ones. There's smaller terms, relative smaller terms that we presume we neglect. You understand? It's the leading order term that lifts the degeneracy is 10 to minus 2. No, in the error here? We look at the spectrum here, and there's quite a big gap to the high states we throw away, you know, of all the J. We're leaving the degeneracy, but we're throwing away states with a large gap. We don't believe that these are going to change. They might. Because we believe the longer range interactions are much weaker in magnitude. It's like adding to the Hubbard model some third nearest neighbor tiny repulsion. Okay. In the main field theory, you won't feel the difference. So I don't believe that it's going to give you a... Okay, so let me summarize that the core actually gives you, from a microscopic Hamiltonian, an effective Hamiltonian non-perturbatively. And this is the point that yesterday, after hearing the talk on putting atoms, nickel, I guess, in band structures, I thought that actually this might be a good method of understanding the low-energy Hamiltonian of systems that naturally separate in space, such as complicated atoms in solids. But we can talk more about it. Yes. You want to see some of that? Okay. Yeah. Very, very, very interesting, the tight binding. The tight binding, yeah, it's a beautiful example of something that doesn't have a very short coherence length, but you see where the method converges well and where it doesn't. And, okay, I'll show, yeah, just a second. So the truncation error can be controlled by a short coherence length, which, you know, is analogous to this silly pictures I saw before about QCD. It's really the kind of emerging structure size. When we apply it to the Hubbard model, we get the plaquette boson fermion model, which I didn't discuss. And then when we apply it to the Pirate law, we lack a symmetry breaking ground state and very low-lying singlets that we believe can help explain other numerics. And we want to develop larger scale computations, and we want to explore the plaquette boson fermion model for cuprates. So this is the end of the formal talk, and thank you very much. You wanted to see the tight binding? Okay, this is just the tail binding energy of the plaquette. Okay. In a tight binding model, you can say I take, let's say, a chain, and I'll cluster every two sites, and every two sites has a symmetric state and an anti-symmetric state. And I throw away the anti-symmetric state, and I write an effective Hamiltonian in the subspace of only symmetric states of every dimer. Now, what will happen is, of course, you do the cluster expansion, very easy to do in this problem, you get interaction ranges, essentially hopping. This is a single particle problem. Everything will be translated in terms of hopping, but the hopping will be long range. So let's look at the band structure. We know the band structure for the full tight binding is a cosine. And we know that here we must have a brilliant zone that is pi over 2. So the question is, can we reconstruct a funny band structure for this model which has a cusp at the edge that reflects the fact that the original model doesn't break any lattice symmetry, and the only lattice symmetry broken is by hand in this cluster construction? What would
you mean? Sorry,
you're a No. Forget interacting electrons. One particle. One particle. One particle problem. Boson, fermion, doesn't it? Okay? This is pi over A. Pi over 2A. It's pi over 2A because you have, you know, you double the unit cell. So you can only get, because you threw away half the states, all these states are out of your Hilbert space. You can only get this spectrum. Question is how good you get these, how well do you get them using this procedure. Now, why were we interested? Because people said, how do you know that you've broken lattice symmetry by hand here? You get some results. How do you know that the real system breaks that lattice symmetry or doesn't break that lattice symmetry? You kind of put yourself in a hole that's difficult to dig yourself out. That's true. It's not a good idea to pick a lattice symmetry breaking unless you're interested in Gaussian energy. But if you want to understand, is there or is there not a lattice symmetry breaking, don't pick the clusters to be exactly the ones that break lattice symmetry in the way you want to find out. Why? Because any finite range hopping will always give you a band structure that will look like this, with a mini gap in the end. It will always come out flat in the end. That's just by the property of periodicity and analyticity of the Fourier transform of finite range. The only way you can get a cusp is if you give infinite range. So now let's look at the... that's working backwards. No, I'm working forward. I'm calculating the range of interactions and I'm truncating. So... Yeah, it's nothing really game of Fourier transform here, but I want to show some interesting fact. Exactly. No, they're not flowing. They're computed. One step. I go from full lattice to dimerized. Stop. Okay. One step. Now, you look at the exact spectrum as this guy. He has a cusp at the end. Yeah. No. Look, the method, the method we know at infinite range couplings yields the precise spectrum, exact spectrum. So that's known. So this band structure should be reproduced exactly if I kept all ranges. The only question is how fast does it converge to the band structure of the infinite range when I truncate at finite range? That's the only question I'm asking. Yeah, right. So as you see here, the range one core is the blue line. It does quite badly. It's really the cosine of 2k when you want to imitate the cosine of k. So you get a very bad ground state energy and quite a bad dispersion, and you come in flat here. You take range two, which is the green line, not too bad already. You take the range three, and it's extremely good, except to the end. So what happens is, you get a very good representation of the spectrum at low momenta, and here you get wiggles that slowly converge, and of course you have to have a power law range to really get convergence here. So, if you're asking questions about the low momenta, let's say if it's bosons, and you want to know if it condenses or doesn't condense, and now you put interactions on, and you're interested in this part of the zone, you can truncate very freely at very short range. But if you're interested in the symmetry breaking area, which is the zone edge of the dimer, then you're in danger and you have to go to large range and see that it converges to a cusp. And that's where the method doesn't work. Yeah, this is the size two. No, this is given to me by the size of the computer. I have a choice of the size of the block and which state I want to truncate. Here I truncated all the spectrum. Here I truncated all the spectrum. I'm varying the range. I'm adding, more and more for blocks of size. And I'm diagonalizing the effective Hamiltonian, which happens to be trivial to diagonalize. Yes. So notice what is going on. The wave functions are not so good because they are very choppy, right? Instead of having wave functions that look like this. It converts very well for the ground state. I know, but my interactions bring all the information back. That's the power of interactions. You're working with degrees of freedom that are essentially a caricature of the real degrees of freedom. You see your choppiness is kind of a plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus. Not a good representation of the short wavelength part of the wave function. But who cares? You care about long-range correlations near Q equals zero, then you can... What? Yeah, I'm interested in essentially the gross features of the wave function beyond the dimerization length. Well, for this particular problem, you can say that because it's just Fourier transform diagonalizes Hamiltonian. But the general idea of... Maybe what you're saying is, I don't know, I difficult for me to follow, but I'm saying a priori I will look at convergence. Let's say I don't know about Fourier transform, nobody taught me that, let's say I missed that class. So I would just follow the lines. And if I see, you know, the green line and the red line extremely close together, I will believe that at least for this part of the spectrum, if that's what interests me, I can truncate at that range. Now, if I see that convergence is very poor, as I see in this, I say, oh, this is a bad clustering, bad way of truncating my wave functions, because I really need all the pi over 2 information here. So this is just an example, which also, I guess, in two dimensions we checked. Also, you see these are the clusters in two dimensions, which is also very fine in clusters. And in two dimensions, the convergence is less good for these kind of clusters, but you get quite good convergence at the low K value. And if you're interested around these dangerous lines, which are the Plaquette brilliant zone, then, you know, you have to go to quite large clusters to get good convergence there. But this is just an exercise of which clusters give me noise and which clusters are nice. And we concluded that one has to resum the clusters in terms of nice shape, in other words, square shape. You could do that. In other words, you could reformulate the cluster expansion in terms of squares alone. That's a resummation. But anyway, that's a technical point. Right. In fact, it matches the curvature of the bottom. Yeah, right. And that's perfect. That's very good. You don't have to go to large range for that. So in other words, the most important part of what you get from this is the hopping at short distances, and then you have your effective Hamiltonian quite well there. So anyway, so I mean, I'm sure there's lots of tricks of the trade that haven't been developed yet, and you know, I hope people will. The effective Hamiltonian, well, here you ended up with a tight binding effective Hamiltonian, didn't get anything. Disorder, I haven't thought about. I haven't thought about disorder. Haven't thought about it. Yes. Actually, the people who did it best is, we should give a talk. I just saw a preprint by them, Didier and Sylvain, and the beautiful results for ladders and 2D also. Well, you see, yeah, because once you do the interactions, you can put it on any lattice you want. Yeah, but the same effective Hamiltonian, let's say, just the effective Hamiltonian I wrote down, if you put it on a one-dimensional lattice, it forms a gap. If you put it on a two-dimensional lattice, it would have a nail state. You see? The Magnon hopping terms. Because in one dimension, the fluctuations, when you put in the constraint right, the fluctuations cannot allow condensation of the magnons, and in two dimensions. No, this is the magnon, I guess, who wrote it first? You guys write it first? Just the triplet singlet representation of the Heisenberg model. It was written, I think, by Maurice Weiss group, and there were ways of representing the Heisenberg model in terms of bosons. What? Right. Oh, on a rung, not a plaquette, right. But the basic idea is that those models have the right physics of Heisenberg in 1 and 2. Yeah, they're different. Similar Hamiltonian, but different constraints. Sorry, what's your question? You can solve it by essentially imposing a constraint on the average, because you have a hot core constraint, and then you. What will cause ordering is the T dagger terms, because they add mix to the ground state triplets. Yes, so solving it by simple mean field, putting a constraint on the average of node, you get a mean field equation that gives you ordering, and we did that. So I guess we're not first one who did that, and there's no. It might not be the most useful representation for the Heisenberg one. But you save yourself. That's one way. Another way is doing. Okay, you could, or you could see that the Hamiltonian is simple enough to do mean field theory, or large S expansion, or. No, it happens. No. That's exactly the point. It happens every. Yeah, right. You get rid of a lot of the local frustration. As you see in the power clause, also in the Hubbard model, a lot of the plaquette size physics is already taken care of, and your physics is much simpler now because it's simpler, it's the physics of bosons. That's a system with a very large, that's infinite coherence length. I think it's difficult, even though I showed you the Padé approximation gave a good ground state, I wouldn't try to attack 1D problems with this method. But in 2D, when there are emerging small structures, that's where it's useful. Yeah, you get hardcore boson.
Then to the next step, you get hardcore boson.
Right.
Then, by what I was computing that, the next step will be again. You guys stop at the hardcore boson.
No, you don't mean field. You don't mean field. Yes, in the power clause, I had to do it. My guideline for when do I want to solve a quantum problem well, and when do I use mean field theory, is how degenerate is my mean field theory. So if my mean field theory is fine, like an Ising model mean field theory, okay, I won't get the transition temperature exactly, but more or less I get the phase right. But if I see that I do mean field theory and there's still a manifold of degenerate mean field theories, I say, okay, I'll do a next step core. That's my guide, but maybe other people have better ideas. But at this point, you have a very legitimate, effective Hamiltonian. It's difficult to find something faster than an old scale. Okay, so if you end up with a fermion problem, I think you don't use this method, but your perturbation theory or, yeah. No, in the corporates, we actually get the boson fermion model, and we haven't solved it. And then we do mean field theory. We do mean field theory separate, but okay, let's not talk about it. But the next step is a new thing to do. I mean,